Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. Fallout continues over Charlotte City Council's closed-door decision to settle a potential suit with the police chief. The mayor calls for improving relations on council, while the Fraternal Order of Police calls for a no-confidence vote against CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings. The CMS board speaks out after ICE detains a man near Charlotte East Language Academy who was taking a child to school. Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs is sworn back into her seat on the court 6 months after she won re-election. A Mecklenburg County property tax increase is proposed. We hear about the impact of tariffs on a local business, and the PGA Championship is in town along with 200,000 fans, some of them sending out mean tweets. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News education reporter James Farrell. Nick Oxner is WBTV's chief investigative reporter. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Ben Thompson is morning and midday anchor at WCNC-TV. Good morning to you all. Welcome back.
Morning.
Morning.
Morning. So let me sum up where we are here on this Jennings story. Charlotte City Council met recently in a closed-door session and decided to pay a settlement to CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings for texts sent to him by former City Councilman Tariq Bakari, which the chief characterized as defamatory. This raised eyebrows because the chief had not yet filed a lawsuit, and the communications, though leaked to the press, were not intended to be public. It also raised eyebrows because the exact amount of the settlement as yet is undisclosed, though it is reported to be between $100,000 and $300,000, and that has raised allegations on the part of some council members about unethical and possibly illegal behavior on council. Okay, is all of that accurate? Ben?
based on our reporting and based on what we know, yes, that is what is currently the situation. It now remains to be seen what other actions are going to be taken. The city attorney, Anthony Fox, not to be confused with the former mayor, Anthony Fox, has said, and other council members have suggested, this could be some sort of misdemeanor or some sort of issue by leaking this information. We spoke to attorney who seemed very skeptical something like that would happen, that would be, for one, the county prosecutor would take something out like that. And for two, there's a tremendous amount of First Amendment coverage that somebody would get in something like this.
Well, Bakari, as I said, Bakari's texts were threatening in that he promised to cripple the chief's legacy and get him fired over a disagreement they were having at the time over protective vests for police officers. But those texts were never intended to be public. Nick, can you successfully sue for something like that?
Well, apparently you don't even have to file a lawsuit to get a settlement. That's why we have the story now, right?
Right.
And we're really meshing two different worlds, the worlds of public service and you know, elected politicians, and the world of employment law. And I think part of why this feels so strange is that those worlds, one has one standard and the other has another, I would say.
And Ben, WCNC-TV spoke with an attorney about why they would settle this suit before a suit had even been filed. And he told you, I believe, that the council was within their rights to settle this matter with the chief without a formal lawsuit being filed. Why?
Well, it's curious because typically for defamation, which is what's being alleged here, you need to prove actual malice. And in addition to that, something that's knowingly false. And people who've seen the text, I think, okay, yeah, it seems a bit aggressive, seems a bit pointed for two city officials to be talking this way, but I'm not sure that everybody's convinced that it was actual malice or knowingly false. It was just, sort of an assertive conversation between two people. So I think that's what is baffling a lot of people this morning, is why did the city feel the need to go ahead and settle something like this when it's not even clear that the lawsuit had a merit according to lawyers. And I think that's where you get in sort of the rub among some city council members saying that there was some sort of corruption happening behind the scenes, that there's something nefarious happening behind closed doors.
Both the mayor and the city attorney, Alex, at one point said that what happened in that closed-door session, including the amount of money paid out in this settlement, could not be discussed because to do so would break the law. Since then, some have taken issue with that. Can some of that information be disclosed? And if so, when might that happen?
In regards to the settlement, the city has not confirmed any of that information. It's a little bit unclear when they're going to, because as we've talked about on the show before, the city doesn't have the best track record with filling public records requests in a timely fashion. So saying that they are going to release the details of the settlement, we have no idea when that could be, because it just seems like everything seems to be on their own timeline.
And at one point,
we should clarify that, you know, the city attorney is correct in saying discussions of a personnel matter are confidential in closed session. That's true. What is absolutely not confidential and explicitly public by law are amounts of any settlement a government enters into. Now, if they haven't ratified a settlement agreement yet, then okay, that's not public yet. But as soon as they sign and finalize an agreement, that dollar amount becomes public. And to Alex's point, I mean, I did my first story on the city of Charlotte not trying to not release settlement numbers about 8 years ago, and they haven't gotten any better since then. But that doesn't mean the law doesn't require that number to be made public.
Ben mentioned some disgruntlement on council about all of this from some members. Councilwoman Victoria Watlington sent an email, and we talked about this last week, to her constituents shortly after all this came to light, in which she said she was, quote, extremely concerned with the level of unethical, immoral, and frankly illegal activities occurring within city government, and that the way the city handled the settlement shows a, quote, brazen disregard for dissenting opinions and the rule of law. And that got pushback from the mayor, who also reached out to Watlington and her ally, Renee Johnson, and appeared to acknowledge that there are festering problems on council among some council members, to which Johnson had this response.
You and I have some healing to do. And I look forward to that opportunity. I want to do something different. Dr. Watlington and I have both expressed frustration with the way things have gone.
Did these problems predate this settlement kerfuffle? I mean, what is the root cause of this disagreement among council members, this friction? Do we know?
Well, I know in Johnson's case, she supported another candidate in the last primary versus the mayor. But I think you're going to have, and you have had, this sort of tensions among council members over the years. I mean, I covered it, you know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, and that's always been the case. Sometimes it happens along party lines. But right now, you only have one Republican on city council. So all the arguing, all the debate, all the contention is happening among Democrats. Ed Riggs, as far as I know, is being silent about all this stuff.
Smart man. The leaking of these texts is not the first and only example of leaks coming from these closed-door meetings that council has legally from time to time. And that has raised some concerns on council. Malcolm Graham suggested that some sort of investigation that might include going through the council members' phones or emails might be in order. And Ben, City Attorney Anthony Fox has said that there will be an investigation and that whoever leaked the details could face criminal sanctions. There is some question about whether such a leak constitutes a criminal action. So WCNC consulted that local attorney I mentioned earlier to find out what would happen if that person is discovered. What did you learn?
That it was going to be unlikely that that would be provable, and not only provable, but prosecutable as well. Because again, at the aforementioned coverage of First Amendment rights, and the city attorney is not the one who would do this. This would be either some sort of independent or the county prosecutor that would have to take up a case like this. And listen, I mean, elected leaders, they hate leakers. You know, the Trump administration hates them. The Obama administration hated them. City leaders hate them. People do not like when information comes out unless it's in a very prescripted way that they want it to be leaked out. So they always hate it. Everybody always hates it. But there's honestly, legally, limited ways to deal with it.
Meanwhile, the Fraternal Order of Police has started voting. They're taking a vote of no confidence against CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings. Nick, voting ends this coming Wednesday, and this, I think, stems from the settlement that we've been talking about that the council reached with the chief. Why would that settlement have triggered this vote?
Well, no, it really stems from I think we could fairly characterize it as a war between Chief Jennings and the rank and file at CMPD, which boiled into the, you know, matters that have required a discussion of a legal settlement. And it at least publicly stems from the rank and file wanting outer carrier bulletproof vests, which is something that former Councilman Tariq Bakari, who sent these texts to the chief, really lobbied and advocated for. But I think it's fair to say, and I think all parties would agree, that there's been rising animosity between at least the FOP and the leadership of the FOP representing the rank and file of CMPD and the chief in his office for quite a while. And so I'm not sure, while it's kind of extraordinary that this is the step that we're at, I'm not sure that it's surprising at this point.
Would it have any impact? This voting ends on Wednesday. If they return a vote of no confidence, what impact, if any, would it have?
I don't think it, you know, legally and in right. fact has any actual impact, although I also don't think it's great look if you're the chief that, you know, your own. I mean, let's not forget the FOP is probably the closest thing to a union representing the police officers. So in some respects, it's exists to challenge any police chief, but still don't think a no confidence vote is the best look.
So everything we've been talking about is the result of texts sent by former city councilman Tariq Bakari, who is not here anymore to be part of all these discussions. He's taken a job with the Trump administration. The majority Democrat council has to, by law now, appoint a Republican to take his place because that was Tariq's political affiliation. Bakari has recommended his wife, Krista, for the job, as we've talked about in the past, but she has been really outspoken about this disagreement on council and critical of the decision to make this payoff to the chief. Might she have poisoned her chances because it's the Democrats on council who will select among several Republicans?
I think she has some things going for her as far as some strong endorsements from Senator Vicky Sawyer, Trisha Cotham. Those are two people who are working on the transit bill, which is really important. But also at the same time, this settlement with the chief is a huge issue. She's being very outspoken about it on social media, and it could cause some reluctancy. And another thing that's happening is council members, a lot of them are probably going to want someone who is not going to seek re-election. Krista hasn't said whether or not she will do that, but it seems like she is interested in holding public political position, considering she just ran for the state house.
Well, former city councilman Andy Doolin and former city councilman Ed Peacock have thrown their hat into the ring. Both of them, I believe, have said that they would not run for re-election. But the other candidate is Andrew Dunn. And there's several other candidates, but among them is Andrew Dunn, the conservative columnist for The Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Who else is running for this, at least in terms of throwing their name into the ring?
There are a number of other community activists there, again, all within like the South Park area. There are a couple people who were ineligible. They signed up, but they weren't eligible to actually run because of where they live within the boundaries. As for the people you mentioned, I think there is precedent for this. If you go back 10 years or so, you know, when they had to pick other candidates for mayor at the time, they don't like people who want the job.
But as we heard from the city attorney, that would be illegal to penalize them for deciding they wanted to run again. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. James Farrell is with us. He's our education reporter at WFAE News. Ben Thompson is the morning and midday anchor at WCNC-TV. Across the street, Nick Oxner, a chief investigative reporter at WBTV, and Alexandria Sands is here, a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Last week, a man was detained by ICE as he was driving a child to Charlotte East Language Academy. It did not happen on campus. It was about a half mile away. Like so many other things involving ICE activities surrounding apprehensions and detainments and deportations, there's a lot of murkiness surrounding exactly what happened, James. The Carolina Migrant Network sent an observer to the scene, we are told, and they say that the man was the father of the child being driven to school. Have we been able to corroborate that?
Yeah, like you mentioned, Mike, this has been such a murky situation. Initially, ICE had released the identity of somebody they said they arrested near the school, and they kind of chided the community for jumping to conclusions that this had anything to do with the school. They identified the man as an undocumented immigrant from Mexico. They said he had a criminal history. But since then, I know our own Julian Berger here at WFAE, he's kind of pushed ICE on this a little bit more and was told that there was actually, it appears that there were two separate incidents. And this first individual who was identified was not the person who was in the car, which was the one that had kind of prompted all this conversation here in the community. That does appear to be a father from within the community, but ICE has not identified that father or explained why they detained him at this point. I know that the school's PTA put out a statement on Instagram yesterday, also corroborating that that there was a second individual who was in this car that they identified as a father within the school community. So at this point, that's kind of all we know. But like you mentioned, there's kind of some conflicting narratives here.
So the second man that federal officials say they arrested, and being from Mexico, they say was here illegally, and they say that he has an extensive criminal history that includes domestic violence, assault on a female, robbery, kidnapping, breaking and entering. Have any news organizations been able to corroborate those allegations?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, maybe some of the other reporters here might know, but I'm unsure of that at this point.
Okay. This became a topic of conversation at Tuesday night's CMS board meeting. CMS board chair Stephanie Sneed.
We know that learning cannot happen where fear lives. To our students and our families, we see you, we support you, you are not alone. And to our educators, thank you for being the steady hands and open hearts in times like these.
She said the board's intention is to create a supportive and safe learning environment, but is that really possible, given that current ICE policy and procedures promise that they will nab people whenever and wherever they suspect them of being in the country illegally, Ben?
Well, I think there's such important background information that I think a lot of people don't realize. And if you go to the comment section on this story on our website or yours, you'll get a lot of reaction, and not that that's reflective of reality, but it is people saying, okay, well, so what? If they were breaking the law, it's okay. And I just feel like we need to explain some background here. There was an immigration rule enacted by George W. Bush, a Republican, not to carry out these raids at schools, churches, hospitals, that sort of thing. And you say, well, why? Why does it matter? You can be a hardliner on immigration, but understand that discouraging immigrant families from going to school or discouraging immigrant families from going to the hospital can not only have a negative impact on them, but on us as an entire society. If you have an entire generation of immigrant kids who aren't educated, or you have families not going to the hospital, that is going to affect all of us. It also, as we've talked about, when it comes to ICE agents and local law enforcement, can breed mistrust with local law enforcement, which makes it harder for our local police to conduct investigations, talk to these communities, and get some valuable information about local crimes from them. And so I just feel the need to sort of explain that broader sense, because I feel like it's sort of being overlooked sometimes and people just think, okay, yeah, why not arrest him? Well, there's a reason that this has been a precedent through four or five administrations.
James.
Yeah, and I think to Ben's point there, too, when we have cases like this that, like we've been talking about, there's conflicting narratives and there's murkiness, it creates a lot of uncertainty. And it feels like lately a lot of these immigration enforcement actions that we've seen have come with a lot of publicity, whether because news outlets are covering or because ICE itself is publicizing it, but not always with a lot of clarity. And those questions, I think, only kind of add to that fear. And for students that go to the school who are worried about their friends, who are worried about their families themselves in their own case, it creates this kind of sense of unease. And I think that's what Chair Sneed was speaking to, and the other school board members who have commented on this have kind of reiterated that point of creating a safe environment. Now, of course, to your question of whether this is something that we can actually do, The challenge here is that, like you mentioned, this did not occur on school grounds. So there's not really anything the school can do to, you know, affect what ICE is doing off of the school property. But certainly it raises concern when it's so close that it people are able to witness it from within the school community.
Well, and when this happened, there was this cry, if that's the proper word, for the school board to say something about this. And now they have. And CMS board member Melissa Easley wrote that the presence of ICE near a drop-off zone was, quote, a violation of the trust our families place in schools as safe spaces. Whether they made this arrest a half mile from the school or whether they made it on campus, do schools here or anywhere for that matter really have any recourse?
Not really, unfortunately for schools. There's not much they can do to control what's not happening on their campus. Now, what CMS has done at this point is kind of just reiterated that it intends to follow federal law that provides that all students, regardless of their immigration status, are allowed to have a free and public education. It's reiterated guidance to schools that, you know, federal agents shouldn't be allowed on campus without a warrant, and that warrant should be verified by CMS. And CMS has also said that they're providing extra counseling for students in this particular case who might be, you know, concerned about what happened here. But beyond that, I mean, I think this kind of highlights some of the nervousness that we're seeing in immigrant communities and in school communities, especially since we know the Trump administration has rescinded this rule that allows ICE agents to go to schools and churches, like Ben mentioned. I think this highlights the tension that has kind of been left in these communities since that decision has been made. And this is a conversation that goes back a few months where people were pushing on the school board to issue guidance and to release a statement after the Trump administration made this decision.
It's another indication of why Congress needs to get involved in all of this and not do this through executive orders, which are repealed by the consecutive administrations that come in or the subsequent administrations that come in. Both the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County found it necessary to raise property taxes last year. This year, the city plans to hold the line, at least for now, on another increase. But Mecklenburg County Manager Dina DiIorio told WBTV they must have an increase if they want to achieve their revenue benchmark.
Nobody wants a property tax increase. I mean, that's always clear, but we really tried to make it the most modest tax increase that we could and still fulfill our goals.
So, Nick, what are they proposing?
So it's a 0.96, just under 1 cent sales tax. And so, you know, it is a property tax increase, which I don't think the county commissioners are thrilled to hear. But you know, it is a tax increase in the smallest sense, I think, possible. You know, unlike the city, a big reason that the county continues to need to raise property taxes, which they did last year as well, is that the county budget has to fund the local portion of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system budget. And so, you know, this global county budget is about a 1.5% increase over last year, $39 million more, and at least a portion of that goes for more money for CMS.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that in a second. If you own a house that's worth $377,000, the estimates are with this proposed tax increase, you'd pay $3 more per month in property taxes. Dina DiIorio is retiring at the end of June, and this is her last budget proposal, which includes that tax increase that she describes as, quote, more conservative than it might have been, and that's because of current economic conditions.
That revenue forecast and the uncertainties on the horizon are key reasons that this budget does not rely on the use of county's fund balance for operating expenses. In order to protect the county, I want to make sure that fund balance is available should economic conditions significantly worsen.
You know, we've been hearing about the possibility of a Mecklenburg County property tax increase for a while now, but this seemed to come as a surprise to some commissioners at their meeting this week. Commissioner Chair Mark Jarrell says he cringed when he heard the proposal because this would be the second increase in as many years, and he wasn't alone in being surprised. Why?
Well, I think first, because they just passed a property tax increase last year. And you know, we've seen local officials, I think local officials across the country, but certainly local officials, city, county officials in Mecklenburg County really have been loath to pass property tax increases. It can be the fastest way to vote yourself out of a job.
But, you know, you have to balance the keeping up with funding the programs that you have to fund and the things you have to do at a good quality level with, you know, keeping this place affordable to live. And that's a very tricky balance.
Mark Jarrell added that just because an increase is proposed doesn't mean, quote, that we have to do it. There's a bright light in the darkness. And Commissioner Phil Malik reacted this way when WBTV asked her about this increase.
And I don't know yet. I've got to go to my people and talk. I'm not going to sit here and make that decision on my own. The people elect us to make the right decisions.
So as Nick mentioned, James, the budget includes Mecklenburg County fully funding the request from Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. They want $28 million more from the county, and Dina DiIorio is recommending that that's what the county give them.
CMS's proposal was very clear in what they were trying to propose, what they were proposing, and that was all about employee compensation. And we know that education is best served when you have a great teacher in every single classroom.
So if fully proposed at the $28 million level, what does CMS stand to gain?
Sure. So that extra $28 million would go toward funding an average 5% increase in the local teacher salary supplement. That's the portion of a teacher's salary that's paid out by the county. So teacher's base salary set by the state, but the county does get to add this little supplement to help boost that total compensation. It would also go toward potential pay raises for non-teaching staff, classified employees. That's like custodians, bus drivers, things like that. A lot of those people got increases in their pay earlier this year, but this district is hoping to expand that to more classified employees. And then a small portion of that would also go toward helping to refresh student devices like Chromebooks. It's part of a longer-term plan that the district has to try to make sure that there's enough funding to continuously refresh these Chromebooks as they need to be replaced or lost or anything like that.
Well, we came to the end of a saga this week. After two recounts and 6 months of court battles and challenges to tens of thousands of ballots, Republican Jefferson Griffin finally conceded to Democrat Allison Riggs in the race for a seat on the state Supreme Court. She was the incumbent. She continued to sit on the court while all of this was going on. But this week, she finally took the oath of office to renew her presence on the court. Afterwards, she talked about remaining resolute through the process and not being intimidated, something she was able to do, she said, because she was protecting the precious and fundamental right to vote.
Voters should not have to fight tooth and nail to have their lawful votes counted. Disappointed politicians should not use courts to try and get a different election outcome.
She didn't mention him by name, but that politician clearly is Jefferson Griffin. The stakes here were high, not just for North Carolina, but for the future of all elections around the country. A court decision, Griffin's concession, Riggs swearing in, ends this chapter. But does that put a button on this, Ben? I mean, could this same playbook come back up to haunt us here or elsewhere around the country in future elections?
You know, I think, Mike, the first time we talked about this 5 or 6 months ago, can't believe it's been that long, we talked about how surprised we were. Because while, yes, it's a Supreme Court seat in a swing state, this was not a deciding, you know, seat. Like, you know, Republicans have way over the amount of people needed to have on the state Supreme Court. So it was shocking to a lot of people that it went this far, considering this was not going to be a tiebreaker seat on the Supreme Court. And, it, you know, we looked into it to see how much was spent on all of this. And, you know, each county was going to cost about a few thousand dollars. But then at the statewide level, once you looked at that, how much did we pay as taxpayers for this? And you realize that the state DOJ, those attorneys don't really log hours like private attorneys do. So we know they had 10 to 12 attorneys on this, you know, at a given time. The state entire state board of elections, they had their entire IT staff. They had three lawyers. I mean, you're talking about a lot of resources, even if we don't actually get the dollar figure devoted to this. That's not even talking about the private money that was put into this race afterwards.
Yeah, she called him a politician. Over the last 6 months, this case has bounced from court to court and jurisdiction to jurisdiction, much was made over which court favored which candidate, which is a comment on our political situation at the moment to begin with. But why has that become such a factor when these people on the state Supreme Court, on courts at all level, Nick, are supposed to decide cases on the law and not on their political affiliation or their political leanings?
Yeah, well, you know, North Carolina further politicized the judiciary about a decade ago in an added party affiliation, maybe a little more than that, but an added party affiliation to judicial elections. We've elected our judges for a long time, but it used to be nonpartisan. And I think what we've seen is a creeping politicization of the candidates themselves. In a former life, before I realized I hated everybody, I ran statewide judicial races, including a race for former Supreme Court justice. And at the time, they were kind of reluctantly out there campaigning because that's what you had to do to get or keep your job. Now I think we've seen an increase in judges and Supreme Court justices who are politicians. I mean, remember Allison Riggs and the other Democrat on the court, Anita Earls, were both progressive lawyers who did election work on behalf of liberals and Democrats. We have Chief Justice Paul Newby, who's far more unabashedly partisan than some of his predecessors. We have former, elected state senators on the court now, and a Republican member of the state House running for a seat. Another who's announced that she's going to run for a seat on the Supreme Court. So it's just the nature of how things go that we have chosen over the course of the last decade or so to map out. I think everyone would agree that the law is the law, but
So this dragged out for 6 months, as we've said. It involved two recounts funded by taxpayers. There were dozens, as you've said, Ben, of lawyers involved, countless court hours. Each candidate's campaign spent money. Riggs spent, I'm told, as much as $683,667 on this fight. Do we have a dollar figure on what this whole thing all in cost everybody, particularly taxpayers?
Not yet. We have certainly tried, and we've been told by the state that they don't have a real way of doing this, since their lawyers, as I mentioned, don't log right. Their hours like private attorneys do. So I don't know when we're ever going to actually get a dollar amount for something like this, what it would cost.
Wow. Well, it's over, at least for now. So that's something to put in the history books, I suppose. When we come back, the impact of Donald Trump's tariffs, at least on one local business here, and then the fact that the North and South Carolina Attorneys General got together to fight fentanyl. We'll talk about that and more when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. James Farrell's with us, WFAE's education reporter. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. Ben Thompson, morning and midday anchor at WCNC-TV. And Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Nick, the reality and the uncertainty created by these Trump tariffs have roiled markets. They've raised concerns about unaffordable products and products being absent from shelves, about businesses being able to order for the holidays. It has business owners across the country, big and small, on edge, especially those who import goods from China, where at one point there was a 145% tariff in place. That has now been lowered to 30%, but it's only temporary, and it's on top of a 20% fentanyl-related tariff on Chinese products and a 10% tariff on everything from everywhere. But it's on again, off again, up and down, and that causes uncertainty. It's all now beginning to hit home. How are local businesses dealing with this?
Not well, I think, is maybe the best way to describe it. Both the costs of the tariffs, but also, as you just touched on, the uncertainty of how much a thing is going to cost that tends to swing from literally day to day.
Michelle Bulow is the founder of the local baby supply business Bella Tuno. Her company sells nationwide. It imports about 90% of its goods from China. And here's how she reacted to these recent tariff reductions.
You know, I woke up feeling like I could breathe. For the first time in weeks, the reduction from 145% to 30%. I mean, it's like I lost 115 pounds overnight.
That's from reporting from WBTV. We hear a lot about how that is impacting both the U.S. and Chinese economies and causing economic growth in both countries to slow. And that's at the macro level. At the micro level, shopping malls, individual stores where business owners and customers are, that's where the pain is going to be felt, I suppose. I know that Donald Trump is a fan of big, beautiful tariffs, but didn't he know that this is what would happen when they kicked in?
You would hope so, and you would hope someone on the staff of economists were telling him and warning him this is what was going to happen. But and you saw him start to change his messaging around tariffs, saying there was going to be a little bit of short-term pain, but it was worth it. I mean, what he's trying to do is shock the economic system in this country and across the world for long-term change, which you can't do overnight, and you can't do without some discomfort. But, you know, I think, again, we've seen, though, these tariffs have already been rolled back to some extent, and we've started reaching agreements with both temporary agreements with China, long-term agreements with the UK. We're negotiating others throughout the world. So I don't think they're here to stay, and he would probably say that was intended that way.
The attorneys general in both North and South Carolina, Jeff Jackson and Alan Wilson, joined forces this week in a bipartisan effort to combat fentanyl and money laundering. Alex, why this effort now?
Yeah, Jeff Jackson is going after the WeChat app. It's a really popular app from China, and he says that law enforcement has found that it's being used to launder money and make payments for fentanyl and to bring it into the U.S. And they're giving the app 30 days to tell them what they're going to do to address this problem. They haven't said what they're going to do if WeChat does not respond, but they could pursue lawsuits. They could try to advocate for stricter laws. We'll just have to see once that date comes, June 11th.
Both these attorneys general met at the government center in downtown Charlotte, and they accused, as you said, the messaging app WeChat of being a key player in both states' fentanyl crisis. Here's Jeff Jackson.
Evidence strongly suggests that WeChat has allowed itself to become an enormous digital pipeline for money laundering that fuels the fentanyl trade. By allowing that to continue, WeChat is essentially helping to bankroll the fentanyl epidemic.
So I'm not sure exactly what states can do to an app that is international. And I'm just curious about this, and I don't know that any of you can answer this question, but if WeChat can be held accountable for activity that takes place on their platform that results in trafficking of fentanyl and other illicit drugs, why can't other platforms be held accountable for allowing the spread of mis- and disinformation that is destroying our democracy? There's a question. I'll just let it hang out there. I know you can't answer it. WeChat, like TikTok, is a Chinese company. Can two American attorneys general have any impact on what that company does? And I ask because Jeff Jackson says there's a range of escalation options which can be taken, and he hopes that the company will see this as a first step by him and Alan Wilson, the attorney general in South Carolina, and that it will be viewed as a small piece of what may be in store if they don't comply. What options do they have, really?
Yeah, I think the whole press conference did really seem like a warning. And Jeff Jackson has talked about WeChat's reputation, how that's something that hopefully they want to not be associated with cartels. But I think that the options really come down to lawsuits, stricter laws. And then North Carolina did pass a law last year, says if you knowingly facilitate money laundering, that is a crime. So that, don't know how useful that will be, but to this Chinese company, but.
So here's something, James, that always ruffles feathers. Changing of school boundaries. And the CMS board is considering the boundaries for a new elementary school that will open next year in 2026, I believe, on Park Road. What does this shuffle look like at the moment?
Right. So the option that has been recommended by Superintendent Crystal Hill at this point would take all of the students who are in the attendance boundary for Marie G. Davis, which is a K through 8 school that has a magnet program within it, and from Dilworth Elementary School and put them into this new elementary school. That would be about 829 students. The new school would open at 85% capacity. There was a second option that was presented by the school's the school board's consultants who have been looking into this that would also take students from Selwyn Elementary School and put them in there, and that would bring it closer to capacity at opening but would help alleviate crowding at Selwyn. But from the community engagement sessions that have been held on this, that there's not a lot of popularity for that option, so I don't know that we'll see that one come to fruition.
And CMS Deputy Superintendent Melissa Bocknight says there could be some exceptions.
So potentially these students would move to the new school in support of the transition because that's where they had planned to move. And then we would potentially move students in the future to another school to maintain the 85% for future enrollment.
What has been the reaction of parents to all this so far?
Well, yeah, and so to Dr. Bocknight, what she's referring to, there are students who have transferred into these schools from out of the zone because the school in their home district is deemed a low-performing school. There's a school policy that allows for that. And that is the one area where the consultants say that they had heard some feedback that families who have transferred into these schools would be hesitant about going back to their home schools. So for those who came there because of that low-performing school policy, they would potentially be able to continue going. But overall, the community engagement has suggested that there's a lot of support for this plan. This has been in the works for a while. It has roots in conversations that were happening back in the fall when the school board rezoned a lot of magnet programs. And now this is kind of, at this point, it's been kind of a long time coming. There's been a lot of talk about it. Again, the only question mark will be those families that will be reassigned to their home schools who are attending these schools right now from out of those zones.
Alex, I have been waiting the entire program to talk about this, and here we go. Under the proposal for the 1 cent sales tax for transit that we sent to Raleigh for their approval to hold a voter referendum on the tax, there will not be enough money for the Silver Line to Matthews. And John Higdon, the mayor of Matthews, and others are upset because they don't believe that what the plan proposes for them, bus rapid transit, is a workable option. And clearly they are not alone. Axios reviewed the results of a survey conducted by CATS asking citizens what they think. What did citizens say? And do not repeat the headline on the Axios story because we can't say it on the radio.
Okay. One person very unpolitely said they do not like the bus. We want trains, all caps. But that was one of the strongest messages of the survey. That's why they won the headline award in Axios. But a lot of the survey responses were just absolutely like roasting the city for even considering the idea of doing bus rapid transit over light rail, just telling them that we would not trust you to put together the gold standard of America bus rapid transit. But that's not going to happen in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we want light rail. Look how good the light rail is. Look how good the blue line is, all the development. And yeah, I can't believe you would even consider it. So that was the gist of the survey. And CATS did listen. They have told their board that they are not going to be recommending a plan that prioritizes bus rapid transit.
Here's what some of the comments said. I know Ben wants to chime in. We'll get to that. Don't be held hostage by bad decisions from the GOP. Charlotte, you're the largest city between Atlanta and D.C. It's time to act like it. The most important thing is to actually build something and not just talk about it forever, which we have been doing, I suppose. We want trains to the airport, trains to Gastonia would be nice, trains to Matthews too. No bus, no cars. We want and need trains. Are you guys out driving and seeing this mess? And then finally, any scenario that relies on bus rapid transit is making the choice to keep Charlotte transportation in the 1950s. Were there any positive comments that came out of this survey at all?
There was people are excited about the idea of transit, and there's a lot of excitement around the sales tax. It's just a matter of put forward a plan that people actually want to vote for.
Ben, did you want to chime in on this?
Yeah, no, I just said I spoke to Colette Forrest, community activist, a few weeks ago. She was holding the Charlotte Black Voter Project. We're having a town hall with the mayor and Alma Adams, and And she pointed out nothing in Charlotte Mecklenburg passes without the majority of Black voters supporting it, whether it's a bond, whether it's a tax, whether it's a referendum. And she said that she felt up until this point that Black voters in Charlotte had been overlooked, had been taken for granted when it comes to the transit, when they would disproportionately be a lot of ones using it, and echoed what Alex was saying about we want trains. The problem with that, and the problem that all of your listeners know by listening to this every day, is the General Assembly says, no, you cannot have all trains. You can have 40%, but no more than that, which brings us to a problem. Hmm.
Well, weeks ago, Cabarrus County Commission Board Chair Chris Meesmer stepped down to fill the North Carolina Senate seat vacated by Paul Newton. And back in April, that unleashed a torrent of maneuvers that we've talked about on the roundup. But Nick, remind us what happened and why it caused such a stir.
In the shortest, broadest way possible, a guy who is vacating his seat on the county commission but had not yet done so voted for his replacement for a seat that was not yet vacant, and therefore it didn't count. A judge has now ruled, and so now the person who was appointed is not on the commission, and a different person has been appointed legally and is on the commission.
And a judge stepped in to prevent commissioners from swearing in the person they chose. And this week, a different person, in fact, was sworn in. Local attorney Jeff Jones. He was appointed by the clerk of court. How did that happen?
Look, this all comes from after three of the five county commissioners met in a kind of early morning hour at a time they knew one commissioner couldn't be there because he had dialysis treatment. They appointed somebody. Again, one of the people making that quorum was the outgoing chairman of the county commission, got appointed to the Senate. And so after that happened, a group of citizens filed a lawsuit to stop this from taking effect. The judge sided with them, saying that appointment wasn't legal. And so here we are now with the clerk making the appointment.
So now for something completely different.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman.
No, it's a DoorDash drone. The future has arrived, Alex. This is your story. What's going on?
DoorDash is delivering Panera, smoothies, whatever you want, but you have to live near the Arboretum in South Charlotte. It's a 4-mile radius, and it's very cool, very futuristic. I got to see it on Wednesday, the day of the launch, and it was pretty effective. It only took a few minutes, and it dropped me off something from Dash Mart, and a little cheer wine bottle didn't explode, so went well.
Yeah, these things fly 200 feet in the air. They fly at 65 miles per hour, which means stuff can get to you quickly. And then what happens when it gets to your location, your house, whatever? What happens then?
Well, it drops you'll hear the drone coming, and you hear the buzzing. It will lower down, and then the actual DoorDash box lowers down with a tether. You should stand a little bit, like 6 feet away from it. And then it'll drop it in like the grass or the sidewalk, and you just run up and get it. And then the drone takes off and it flies back to the Arboretum parking lot, and it lands on the charger there.
What if you don't pick it up? What if you don't hear the drone? What if you don't know that it's arrived? What then?
Well, there is a tracker on the app, so you'll know when it's there. But also, like, I live in an apartment building and people leave their DoorDash on the doorstep all the time. So I do not think that would be uncommon anyways.
Okay, well, so the future is here. When's it going to spread out around the whole city with these drones? When
they said later this year they're going to go to other Charlotte neighborhoods, and it's going to be pretty easy for them to set up once they have all the regulations in place for this initial charging station. It's really easy. It's lightweight infrastructure, so they can start popping them up throughout the city.
They need to figure out how to carry people. Then we wouldn't have to have trains or buses. We'll just have drones pick us up. The PGA Championship has come to Quail Hollow. It got off to a rainy start this week.
The rough is thick, and the run-up areas after this kind of rain are going to be really soft, and the greens are still going to be really firm because they're new. So you have to be able to land the ball on the green. You can't really run it up around this golf course. So that's one aspect that you got to think about. But as far as my approach to the course, not really. I mean, I know what my skill set is, and I'll try to use that to my advantage.
That's the world's number one golfer, Scottie Scheffler, who is here along with 200,000 fans, some making snarky comments on text messages. The good news is that the weather looks clear for the rest of the tournament. Alex, I have 15 seconds. What's the economic impact of this to the city?
It's supposed to be over $100 million. That's what it was in 2017, so it should exceed that.
Take that snarky comment. All right. Alex Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Ben Thompson reports for WBTV. He's their chief investigative reporter. That's Nick Oxner, the chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Ben Thompson, however, is the morning and midday anchor for WCNC-TV. And James Farrell is education reporter at WFAE. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.